on behalf of the Association of Gastrointestinal Motility Disorders, or also known as AGMD. I'd like to welcome you all here today for a SIPO, a pseudo-obstruction telephone internet community support group meeting. Before I begin, I'd like to introduce myself. My name is Mary Angela, that's the first name. Last name is DeGrazia DiTucci, big name, little person. I'm a longtime patient who suffers from chronic idiopathic intestinal pseudo-obstruction. So I have a long name and I have a long illness, which over the years has progressed to include my entire digestive tract. Like many of us, I also have numerous other non-digestive diseases and symptoms that either overlap other medical conditions or even symptoms for which there doesn't seem to be any explanation. It seems like some of the tests that we take, they come back normal, and it's frustrating because we know that we're experiencing these things. And so someone had used this comment, and I always share it, that I don't think they've made a test for what we have yet. In 1991, I was very privileged to have started the Association of Gastrointestinal Motility Disorders. It is a nonprofit international organization that provides support, education, awareness, and advocacy, and promotes further research in the specialized area of gastroenterology. My symptoms began suddenly in 1979. I was 26 years old. I experienced abdominal pain, constipation, mucus diarrhea, abdominal distension, nausea, and went from doctor to doctor trying to find out what the heck was wrong with me. The doctors, in their good intentions, many times misdiagnosed me. And some of those misdiagnoses was fatty colon, stress-induced, irritable bowel, it's all in your head, and later anorexia nervosa. Over the course of 5 years, my symptoms continued to get worse, and with no relief at all with anything they gave me. I was given antispasmodics, tranquilizers, antidepressants, and still no change in my symptoms. At one point, my weight plummeted down to 69 pounds.
Wow.
I couldn't even look at myself in the mirror because of the sheer terror of watching my once healthy body turn into a fragile skeleton. All the while, I continued seeking help. I then went to a local doctor, surprisingly, who suspected I might have a motility disorder. Had no clue what a motility disorder was. But after many tests, it was confirmed that I did, in fact, have chronic idiopathic intestinal pseudo-obstruction. I was elated. It finally had a name. It qualified what I was going through. However, that sense of relief quickly turned to disbelief as I learned that it was a rare disease. At the time, I was told that I was only one of 50 patients in this part of the country with pseudo-obstruction. And the only treatment that they offered me at that time was to have a portion of my intestinal tract removed. At 69 pounds, I really didn't think I could make it through the surgery. Little was known about pseudo-obstruction, and I had too many questions that were begging for answers, such as, if they remove part of my intestinal tract, would I get this pseudo-obstruction in another part of my GI tract? Yeah. What caused this to happen? And would the surgery make me worse? In my case, I evaluated, and for me, there were too many unknowns for me to take that surgical risk. So after a very long deliberation, I opted not to have that surgery. The doctor at that time told me that I definitely needed to see a psychiatrist, and he felt I must have something to gain by being ill and that I was acting like a martyr, and he was disgusted with my husband, who remained by my side because my husband supported me and my decision. With that, I stormed out of the office, and I was left for several years without a doctor in this chronic illness. In my case, it ultimately was the best decision for me. And remember in 1997 when our organization, which originally was called the American Society of Adults with Pseudo-Obstruction, we had our first symposium, and one of the physicians who was one of the heads in this particular hospital that I was diagnosed with, and he's ultimately a motility expert. They call him one of the gurus. He came up to me at the end of the program and said, I am so sorry for what you've gone through, and I just want you to know that at that time, we did the very best that we could, and he gave me a hug. That changed my whole thought process in my past of what I was going through. Now, right. Many years later, the pseudo-obstruction has progressed to include my entire intestinal tract, including my stomach, gastroparesis, esophagus. I have achalasia, reflux, diffuse esophageal spasms, dysphagia, bladder problems, biliary system, and along with that, I have pernicious anemia, malabsorption, and so many other diseases, the latest being mitochondrial disorder. There is no other explanation as to why I have lived for so many years except to say it's truly a miracle. At the tender age of 26, I was told I would not live very long at all, and yet here I am, over 36 years later, I'm alive and living the most incredible, rewarding life. When you live each day in the balance, the appreciation you have for the littlest things, as well as the life itself, is immeasurable. And I'm certain in so many ways we have changed as a result of our illness. During this program, I encourage you to share your input, your questions, concerns, suggestions, and experiences as they relate to living with food obstruction. We do want to make sure that everyone would like to join in the conversation, because I know some people dislike to listen, but if they do, that everybody has the opportunity to do so. And so we ask that everyone be certain not to monopolize the conversation, especially where we only have 1 hour of talk and so many people meeting today. We also ask that you be mindful of other people's privacy, so do not share your contact information with anyone during this program or request any contact information from others. If anybody is interested in communicating, they can email me or call me, and I'll see if that person is interested in communicating with you. And lastly, please state your first name or an alias name before you talk. If you find it difficult to join in the conversation, just call out my name. Again, my first name is Mary Angela, and I'll be certain to facilitate you into the conversation. Of course, I realize it's hard to summarize all of our medical journeys with the very limited time that we have. And I realize that our conversation may lead to many different avenues related to pseudo-obstruction. But know that these meetings take place each month, and as they occur, I am confident that each person will come away with more knowledge, support, friendship, and always hope. And on that note, we are going to begin this program in a little bit different of a way. Typically, I invite you right away to bring a little bit about yourself to the conversation and what brings you here. But Candace is a poetess, and she's going to open a program with something related to, for those of you who aren't aware, our organization has an Inspire community site online where people can keep a journal, they can pose discussions, they can have questions, and it's a very, very supportive environment. And
great.
Candace has been part of this, and she would like to share one of her poems about that with everybody. Candace?
Right. Hi, everybody. It's Candace. I call this poem Team Inspire. I'm making friends here on Inspire, the kind of friends who don't require that I smile and be at my best, who don't consider me a pest when I'm down or need to vent, who words of support so gladly sent. These are people I've never met. They're only names to me, and yet I feel a closeness to them all, and I never fail to heed their call when they reach out, too sick to cope with their lives, and I send them hope in the form of words and offered prayers. Here there's no need to put on airs and pretend to be stronger than we are. This is our community, and we come from afar to offer support, encouragement, advice, opportunity each day to do something nice. If I can share in another's pain, I find that I'm the one to gain. So here's to those who run this site. I thank you with all my might.
That is absolutely beautiful. beautiful.
Well, Teen Inspire means so much to me. When I was hospitalized this last month with a pseudo-obstruction and had to be off the site for a week, I missed it desperately. I get so much encouragement, so much support from all the people on the site. And I encourage those of you who aren't already part of the Inspire website to sign up for the AGMD gastroparesis and SIP support group. You can ask questions, benefit from other people's advice, use your experience to give advice to people who are new to this disease, and it kind of makes sense out of your suffering to be able to share it and help somebody else because of it.
Beautifully stated. And I know that some of you here today do not do internet or do not have a computer and they use a phone. I think that you will find that same atmosphere, or I pray that you do, here in this conversation. Sometimes when you don't have other people to talk with or communicate with, and you have especially something like pseudo-obstruction or gastroparesis, some of these other things that the outside world really doesn't know. I mean, if you mention pseudo-obstruction in the
pseudo,
outside
fake,
of the world,
fake.
The first thing they say is, yeah, pseudo, it's in your head. And then the second thing that they say is, what the heck is that? And then some of them may even say, well, you don't look ill. It won't be that bad. And they don't understand all that encompasses living with pseudo-obstruction. So,
right, with my
isolation,
TPN, I've been able to come up. This is Candace again. With my TPN, I've been able to come up to something approximating a normal weight. And you're right. People look at you and they say, you look fine.
Yeah.
And I've even got one doctor who says, you look too good to be so sick.
Yeah, well, you know, and many of us, in trying to incorporate living with pseudo-obstruction and trying to have some sort of normalcy in a life that is so complex and really not normal for the average person, you try to perhaps look good. Or you perhaps try to hide it in public, or sometimes it's difficult. But in the outside world, it's really, really hard. Everybody here today, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I just wanted to make a comment with regards to getting people to understand the word pseudo-obstruction. With my contacts or friends that have no idea what that word might mean, other than I'm a psychologist and I'm telling them that I have a pseudo-obstruction, which means that, you know, I don't really have an obstruction. I've just started to use the general term of intestinal failure so they understand that my intestines aren't working.
Right, or intestinal inertia or ileus.
Yep. That's excellent.
Those are words that people understand.
Yeah, I remember when...
I've been diagnosed with a lot of things like that. So.
I remember when I... talking to physicians when I was diagnosed, and I said, everybody is starting to relate it to the head. Isn't there, can't you name it after somebody? Can't you name it something else? And I also remember, and I've explained this story to many people before, that when we were at an exhibit at Digestive Disease, and then we offered with a special symposium. And we hooked up to that. And at that time, many years ago, we were exhibiting, and this one doctor stopped in front of our booth and just said, blurted out, you mean they actually have an organization or something like this? And then he came and he grabbed some M&Ms from our table, you know, he ate. And I just was stunned that a physician would actually say this and laugh. And then moments later, my faith was so restored. This one doctor came up to the booth and said, oh, my God, I am so glad to see you here. I have one patient, and this patient is so alone and needs support. I am so grateful that your organization exists and started picking up all the literature that we had, and that restored it. We need more awareness, and that's what our job is. And it's people like you, and you know, you may be suffering greatly, and I'm sure all of you have throughout the course of your illness. But in suffering, I also say this all the time, whether it's something you signed up for or not, believe me, I don't think anybody would be the first ones to sign up, wait in line, and sign up to have pseudo-obstruction. However, because of your illness, and even because it's a rare disease, you automatically then become teachers. Whether you realize it or not, whether you felt you were a good teacher or not, you automatically become that way, because when you are in a hospital, when you are in an emergency situation, when you are at a social function, if you're able to have a social function, no matter where, you are educating people, including
right.
your family and friends and employees. Is there anybody else who would like to talk about their, what brings them here, and a little bit about their background, or if you have questions? No, we have a quiet
okay, this
group
is
today.
Candace again. I just wanted to know what other people do, how they determine when it's time to go to the hospital. My most recent bout, I have an ileostomy, having lost my colon to what they diagnosed as colonic inertia in 1997, and which was diagnosed as SIP in 2000. Because once having gotten rid of the colon, the intestine shut down. And I had first what they called intestinal inertia, and then after many hospitalizations, they came up with the diagnosis of SIP. And my latest bout, I had 72 hours of no production, nausea, vomiting, and I didn't finally pull the plug and go to the ER until I was actually vomiting stool. And my GI said that I had waited too long. But for me, it's normal within any given week to have a period of 24 to 36 hours where I'll have no production. I'm now taking Relistor injections daily and seem to be doing a little bit better.
What kind?
Relistor. It's a subcutaneous injection. The drug is actually intended for intestinal inertia caused by opiate usage.
Okay.
But we've been using it off-label. We were using it every other day. And since my hospitalization, I've been using it every day and haven't had any more episodes, at least that have lasted more than 36 hours. But when do you pull the plug and decide it's time to head for the ER?
Did they decompress you while you were there with an NG tube?
Oh, yeah, an NG tube, and immediately 4 liters. I mean, just changing the bucket time after time after time.
And then did they immediately go
4 liters out, and my distension
and
went
a
down.
And then a lot of electrolyte balancing?
Oh, yeah.
A lot of electrolyte, and then the CPN?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I went
is everybody is everybody here on? Does anybody else here have? First of all, before we respond to Candace's inquiry, is there any other people on this call that have an ileostomy?
Yes.
Yeah.
Pamela.
Okay, so there are some people. Are there any people who are on tubal feeding?
Yes.
Okay. Are there any people on this participating in this program who have pseudo obstruction but have never had surgery for it. Oh, wow. That's interesting. So I'm the only one.
Uh-oh. Who haven't
That's
had
very
surgery for it.
I have not for that. So I think would anybody now who can relate to what Candace's question is or have had experiences with that, is there anybody who would like to respond? And I just want to remind you to say your first name, even if you have talked before, just so that people can identify the response. Is there anybody else who have had to make those decisions about when to go to the hospital?
Yes, Pamela.
Pamela? And
Hi,
what
Pamela.
What constitutes you? When is your cutoff point when you say, I guess I have to visit this?
Well, when I can't get up without vomiting and I actually physically cannot walk, I let it get to that point because I have had negative experiences with emergency room where they don't know what to do with me. But in this case, because the obstruction was so tight, the pseudo obstruction, that there was also blood coming from the stoma, and I had recent treatment by a gastroenterologist for what he diagnosed as acute gastritis, and he was a friend of the emergency room doctor, and they called him, and so they immediately assumed that I had a GI bleed, and I had developed aspiration pneumonia from the forceful vomiting. So I also had aspiration pneumonia. So then, obviously I made the right call. I had to be there. And so those two things got me in, and then we went from there.
I think that it's also helpful if you have a great doctor who really is an expert in pseudo obstruction, or you have a doctor who at least is willing to understand, that physician may be able to write a protocol so that when you have an emergency, the doctor will understand what the treatment should be, what to look for, and what the protocol is you individually. How many of you with pseudo-obstruction have had the pseudo-obstruction? Well, let me ask this first. How many of you have pseudo-obstruction secondary to another medical problem? Okay, so these are all
maybe
uncertain.
Yeah, I don't know. This is Candace. I don't know if mine is secondary to any other problems. I have a neurogenic bladder, which I developed before the pseudo-obstruction, type 2 diabetes, and gastroparesis, which were diagnosed before the pseudo-obstruction. But I think I've been living with pseudo-obstruction for probably close to 20 years. And it was only diagnosed, 14 years ago.
Wonder,
Pamela?
A lot of people, this is Mary Angela, but a lot of people, and I don't know if people are aware of this, but mitochondrial disease is a disease that's really making a lot of headlines, and it's also, there's a lot of research that is being done on this now, thankfully. And what they find with mitochondria, everybody has a mitochondrial, has mitochondrial, which is the cell that, the cells in your body that convert everything to energy. And when you have this mitochondrial disease, they're finding that in some cases, it is linked with pseudo-obstruction. So I know that a lot of patients with pseudo-obstruction, they may have autonomic dysfunction, feeling like you're going to pass out, feeling blood pressure changes, feeling that you can't tolerate lights, that you can't tolerate confusion. There's a lot that goes on, that you're always, you have an inability to regulate your temperature. It affects so much of your body. that they're finding that there can be, in certain cases, a relationship for those who have suit obstruction. There's a connection to it. And that goes for many other GI problems, but they're finding like MS falls into this category. Lupus can fall into this category, and the list is going really big time because the more they're researching, the better it is. It doesn't necessarily mean if you get tested for mitochondrial disease that if the test comes out negative, it doesn't mean necessarily that you don't have it. So there are many different ways to do it, but the best way is to go to an expert in mitochondrial disease. So that's something I don't know if anybody is aware of, and I know years ago this one girl, when I had suit obstruction for years, she came and said, you know what, I have mitochondrial disease, I think that's what you have, and I said, no, it's fine. And then little by little, I got more disease, more symptoms, more symptoms, different kinds. And then it was becoming so debilitating, and then it was said, you have mitochondrial disease. There we have it. That's the answer. So sometimes when it's hard to connect the dots, they're looking at one area, but it could be something else. Just
what kind of doctor diagnoses mitochondrial disease?
It is a mitochondrial disease expert. There is, for example, a doctor in Massachusetts. His name is Dr. Mark Corson, and he's at Tufts Medical in Boston. And he is an expert in that. You can also go to, for example, a geneticist, somebody who sees a lot of different types of things. So different types of doctors, but you, in the first inquiry, even some neurologists may be familiar with it. You need to make sure that they have expertise in that.
Right.
Any other genetics?
This is Pamela. I have rheumatoid arthritis, which is sometimes you can have an arthritis where it's seronegative, but you have it, and I've been seeing a rheumatologist for that. Lupus runs in my family, and with rheumatoid arthritis and lupus, sometimes they can have like some intestinal symptoms similar to pseudo-obstruction. So I just happened to go off the medications for my rheumatoid arthritis, and then I had to be given a medial dose pack, which is a steroid dose pack, with the methotrexate so that I could get things back on track. And I found an improvement in my pseudo-obstructive symptoms during the period of time when I was on the steroids.
But interesting.
This is Candace. I just wanted to say something to Pamela, who said she's had bad experiences in the ER, and so she waits until she can't even walk anymore. I have found that for me, it really greases the skids if I call my GI to let him or his partner, if he's not covering at the time, to let my GI know that I'm headed to the emergency room, and he calls ahead and orders the NG tube, the X-ray, CT scan if necessary, gets everything put in
lined
line, and they're waiting for me when I get there. And
that's
it
wonderful.
Sure eases the ER experience.
Wonderful.
That's,
I'm wondering,
nice.
is there anybody on this in this participating in this event who has such severe pain that is not addressed? So I'll have you okay with that. Is there anybody here who has had suit obstruction that has progressed to other parts of the digestive tract?
Yes.
Excuse me?
Candace,
is there anybody? Is there somebody else? I see somebody else is trying to get in.
But
Is there anybody else who has suit obstruction where the suit obstruction has progressed to include more of the digestive tract? That was the question.
Oh, yeah, this is Bethany, definitely, yeah.
Bethany, hi. Tell us a little bit about what's happened with you.
About 5 years ago, I lost 50 pounds because it started hurting to eat, and then I didn't know what was wrong with me. They said I had IBS and, you know, all different things. It's kind of the same story as everyone. And I ended up going to Mayo Clinic in 2009 to get a diagnosis, and it started with the right colon, and they thought that maybe it was because when I was a little bit younger, I had a cecal volvulus that's so tight, turned gangrenous and curved open, and I had sepsis, you know, in my abdomen. So I was thinking that all my problems were just because of that. But since, as time has gone on and I've had all of my colon removed, it's spread to my small intestine and to my esophagus and so forth. But something interesting I was going to say was I was curious to know if anyone else has any family members that also have this disease, because when I was at Mayo, I met with the head of genetics, and the strange thing with me is my father died at age 38 with, I think, with something related to pseudo obstruction. His brother died at 26, and I have a cousin that got started on CN, and they think I have somehow inherited this dominant form of food obstruction. So,
Good question. Does anybody else have a genetic component in it?
Not that I know of, Candace.
Okay. Well, Bethany, the last time that we were, I think, on this call, but you participated in so many. You were in the hospital, correct?
Yeah, correct.
Are you in the hospital today?
Luckily, no, knock on wood. But I've been having an issue, and something that complicates my pseudo-obstruction issues is that I've had so many surgeries, of course, and have lesions, which can cause true obstructions, but I also have a birth defect where I was born without enough mesentery to kind of hold everything in place, and so I just have volvulus, that's the twisting of the colon. I have volvulus after volvulus after volvulus, so people are talking about when you have to go to the ER. My doctors have instructed me, even if you think it's a pseudo obstruction, you have to go and make sure it's not a real obstruction. And lately, I've been having monthly, or at least bimonthly, true obstruction. I don't have a colon, so these are in the small intestine. So anyways, my doctors in Omaha, which is 3 hours from where I live, they are looking into possibly doing another surgery to do a light of adhesions and see if that will help me from having so many recurrent actual obstructions. So anyways, there's so many crazy things going on with me right now, but I recently had a colonoscopy at one of these hospitalizations, and they found that a surgeon accidentally, I assume, left a guide wire that's pierced
my
intestine. So, anyway, so all my doctors are freaking out, except for the surgeon, I suspect, that left it, and he's trying to claim that it's a suture. I don't know what to do, because the person that they want me to have surgery with a lysis of adhesions is a surgeon that left the guide wire and is saying that it's just a suture, so I don't really trust them, but there's no one locally that can help me. I live in Kansas City, so I am I'm just going to start, I think, cold calling different places. I just have to do it, and I really need help from another institution.
Yeah. Do you have a teaching hospital near you? This is Candace.
You know, I have University of Kansas Medical Center, which you would think would be able to help me, but they can't. And even Nebraska, which is the closest intestinal rehab program to me, they really just deal with pediatric patients. So really, I'm kind of stuck in this little oasis. I have no one nearby. I've been to every GI person, probably within a 300-mile radius. I'm exaggerating, but you see what I mean?
And I was wondering.
Yeah, nobody wants me. So
yeah. I was wondering if you could possibly find a surgeon who's skilled in the robotic lap assist, because if you have a lot of adhesion, a lot of surgeons don't want to take you on as a new patient. And luckily for me, at the hospital that I went for the severe emergency, the surgeon was very methodical. Once the emergency passed and I saw him in his office, he wanted to get the last records from the University of Chicago where I had had most of my surgery. And then from there, he met with me and said he'd be willing to take a diagnostic lab to just take a look to see if he thought he could do anything for me. And then once he did that, he got approval for him to go in with the Da Vinci robot. He said someone with all the adhesions that I had couldn't really be safely entered with small cuts and not the robot, which can magnify by 10 times, and it has use of two tools at one time to work together. And although there's pros and cons to using robots for surgery, for patients like us that have gone through surgeries and have had multiple surgeries and possibly complications such as severe infections, it's just such a safer technique, and I really am thankful that I found a doctor that he wasn't able to fix me, obviously, but he was able to fix the problem that was eminent at the time.
Did you say that was in Chicago?
Actually, Chicago is where I had my initial surgery, but this is a suburb about 50 to 60 miles from Chicago, and the surgeon actually just practices at that one hospital, which has about 300 to 400 beds. He has been at teaching universities before in his career. He's approximately 50 years old. But currently he chooses to be a surgeon rather than a teacher. And he was explaining to me that, he was trying to enlist my trust, but he said one of the things that you run into, and I don't want to scare anyone away from teaching hospitals, but one of the things he says you run into at teaching hospitals is though you meet with the surgeon that's the main surgeon, there's always those head residents and chief fellows and so forth that are on your case, and everybody's cutting. He may be present for the entire surgery and may document that in the report, but he said a lot of times that I guess maybe he had experience, and that's why he was saying that a lot of times that surgeon then has to, in surgery, fix what the other doctors may have blundered on. And he said,
very familiar.
And so he said with me, you know, he said the university that I had been at happens to have a satellite in his hospital, not in his hospital, but the hospital where he practices. And he says he meets with them regularly to see, you know, how their, you know, what their success and complication rate is like. And he said it's so much higher than what we have here. It's just not where it should be, and they're working on that. But, you know, University of Chicago in the Midwest would be known as, like, one of the best places to go for GI surgery, other than if you were going to Mayo or something. I didn't know that at the time.
Well, thank you for that input. I really appreciate that.
You know, a lot of people who are unfamiliar with soup obstruction, they don't realize that the emotional roller coaster that patients and their family members go through is huge. And I think, you know, when you're going through all of these struggles and you have a disease that affects you socially, that affects you, your ability to perhaps be employed, that is, the symptoms can be unpredictable, that it's going to affect relationships. All of these things. When you mentioned stool obstruction, there are so many components that go with it. And I know for myself, you know, when you are having, and Candace had touched upon this, it was her Inspire poem, but when you are going through such difficulty, sometimes it's really hard to mentally deal with the challenge. And then you try to have that positive attitude, but you have that fear that gets into your head, there's that frustration, perhaps the questions keep going in your head, and it's the unknown area. It's really unknown of what's happening to you or what's going to happen or the decisions you make. So, but then once you get through that, the difference in your attitude can make a huge difference. But that fear is rampant, and the frustration and perhaps bitterness, angerness, all of those sometimes collide. And with some people, when they have a different type of illness, it may be chronic, but they go through the period of mourning, where you are angry, you're sad, you get all through that. But then once you finally accept it, you accept it, and that's it. When you have pseudo-obstruction, what often happens is you go through all of those emotions, and then they kind of stabilize once you say, all right, I've accepted this, I'll deal with it. And then as soon as a new symptom happens, or you get another problem, or you get some sort of a comment that triggers it, suddenly you have to go through that whole process again, and watching other people eat and not being able to eat normally and not being able to go to social events, watching people come in and out of your life and you find out truly who your really good friends are.
Yeah.
All of those emotions collide, and I know that each and every one of you at different stages of your illness, I don't know if some of you are just beginning to the journey, beginning to live with food obstruction. Perhaps some of you are not totally diagnosed with it definitively, or perhaps you're going through a real challenge right now, or perhaps you're a veteran like I am, who lived with this for years. No matter where you are in your life, I am sure at various points, if not right now, you are all feeling or have felt that emotional roller coaster. Am I correct?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Is anybody going through a tough time emotionally right at this moment?
Yes.
Who, name? Is it Stephanie?
Bethany. Yeah.
Bethany.
I don't want to monopolize it, but yeah.
And no, that's okay, because I'm sure there are people who are just listening who can relate to that emotional battle that you experience.
Yeah. It's just frustrating. You know, you speak of the emotional issues, and everything you said, I know I can relate to, and I'm sure everyone else can too, but it's something that hasn't been, well, you kind of touched on it, was, and I think this is the reason that people are, you know, worried about going to the ER, is that I know that we've all had such negative responses by some physicians, whether it be in the emergency room, by hospitalists, by GI doctors that don't get it, you know, and I'll admit that's, you know, one thing that has really beat me down, I think, more so than even the physical, you know, processes of this illness. Is one thing that I'm having a lot of extra symptoms lately, where I've been vomiting spontaneously and so forth, and just all kinds of crazy stuff. And my doctors that are 3 hours away, I called and asked them for advice, and they called me back and said, well, this is your fault because you are taking narcotics. And I don't know if anyone else has dealt with this, but I am on narcotics because it's so incredibly painful to eat right now. I don't know if the wire stuck in me has part to do with that. But I think a lot of doctors, it's like what came first, the chicken or the egg. You know, it's like they almost think horse narcotics have a slowing effect on the entire GI tract. That some doctors think, well, she's not really having pseudo obstruction. I bet she just has narcotic illnesses, you know, caused by this narcotic use. And they think that, you know, you are to blame for your pseudo obstruction symptoms. And
right.
That's just, you know, I've had so many doctors. I mean, just this last hospitalization, I had to get, thank God I have a wonderful PCP. Who I have his cell phone number, and when they're yelling at me at my bedside, I pick up the phone, and this doctor came in the room, and he said, well, this is when I had an actual obstruction. And he said, well, you don't look like you're in pain. So are you just taking this medication? Just take it. And, you know, just totally, you know, being so rude, it was so much worse than it sounds. But anyways, my PCP has been telling all these doctors, finally, after years of struggling with this and being labeled on my chart as this is a drug seeker, this patient's just totally faking abdominal symptoms to get drugs, he finally is telling these doctors and hospitalists to treat me as if I were an oncology patient. And, you know, because I don't think, you know, they don't, he gets how horrible the, you know, the symptoms are and, you know, the effect on our lives emotionally, physically, but these other doctors don't get it. And, of course, the word pseudo obstruction doesn't help, so.
Bethany, this is Candace.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering, I mentioned that I take Relistor injections daily, and I'm just wondering whether that's a drug that might help you. I take Percocet for pain very, very rarely. My pain has to be up around an 8 or a 9 before I will take anything that will slow down my intestinal activity. But
right.
The Relistor is specifically designed for intestinal inertia caused by opiate usage. And it might be something that you want to investigate with your GI that might help you have fewer episodes of pseudo obstruction. Just a suggestion.
Yeah. No, that I appreciate that. The problem is when I have a true obstruction, it's so painful. And I've had so many surgeries that, you know, your body becomes resistant to medications and, you know, you have no choice but to take these medications at some point. Every time I try to taper off and, you know, get to where I'm using nothing, I go through withdrawal, all this things, and then before I can, like, let my body reset itself, I'm in the hospital again and having another surgery. Where, you know, so it's like,
yeah,
you know what I mean? It's like I can't, I'm trying to try. Luckily, I have a specialist, pretty cool, and he actually suggested that I, at least with what I'm going through right now, going to the hospital every month with a real obstruction and potential for surgery every time. Go ahead and just stay on them on fentanyl patches, which I know is pretty drastic.
Right.
But that's what I need right now. So.
Yeah, I wasn't trying to suggest that you stop taking opiates. On the contrary, I'm saying that, you know, if you have to take opiates every day, and I know there are a lot of us who do, that maybe the addition of Relistor might help your symptoms.
Okay.
But just it's Relistor. If you want to mention it to your GI as maybe something that you could add to your regimen that might.
Yeah,
give you some
I already
relief.
Wrote it down on my little notepad. So thank you.
Yeah.
I'm interested if anybody else here has allergies or have allergies or sensitivities to medications, perhaps some that they could take before and now they all of a sudden are getting some sort of a reaction to it, or sensitivity, or even with other things like different foods if you're able to eat, environment, anything like that, because that seems to be another common thread of people with this.
Candace, I have a lot of allergies and really bad chronic asthma because of them. And I've also developed allergies to the two big pain relievers, morphine and Toradol. They now give me hallucinations if I'm given them.
So oh, my gosh.
They're on my list as drug allergies, and so I'm left with Dilaudid and fentanyl.
It's very hard. And I know a lot of patients, if they're able to eat at all, their repertoire of foods can get smaller and smaller and smaller. And so many of us have what we call our safe foods, even though it doesn't make sense to a lot of people. And even though those safe foods can cause symptoms to become exacerbated, just because there are so many foods that have caused it, you begin to wean down what you have as far as selections that you're courageously willing to try. I wonder if that has happened to any of you.
No? I'm laughing, Candace. I'm laughing because I'm drinking a boost as we're talking. I'm on TPN, but I supplement with 4 or 5 boost shakes a day. But I have to sip them over a 30 to 45 minute period. In order to make sure that they don't come back up again. And when I go out to, quote, eat, more likely than not, I'll have tea and toast or a boiled egg or a sugar-free Jell-O. My list of safe foods has dwindled dramatically. There are very, very few foods that that I can eat anymore.
I understand. You deal with that fear all the time. I just want to suggest something to people on this call if they're unaware of it. We find that it's very individual. So what works for one patient may not necessarily work for another. So you always have to keep that in mind, because I talk to other pseudo-obstruction patients and go, oh my God, you mean they can exercise, they can run, they can do this, they can do that, they can eat this, they can do that. I'm saying, what do I have, something else here? But that being said, when I know for myself, when I have a really, really bad exacerbation of it, I have a wonderful husband. I'm so blessed to have him. And what he does is he will literally deeply massage my back. And sometimes, even if I have esophageal spasms, sometimes by doing that, not all the time, but sometimes it can help ease the spasm or whatever is happening in there. When that doesn't work and it's just getting worse and worse, that's when I know, time to go. But also, if you're on the toilet seat, and I know in my case, I don't go. I have to manually de-impact myself. And even then, it's so little at a time. So when that happens, sometimes on the toilet, I will press by my belly button. And if it's not really painful for me to do that, that will help to, not at that particular point, but maybe later on, it may help to move stool. So just a few suggestions. I don't know if anybody has tried that massage, but it possibly can help, as long as you can clear it with your doctor, if there's a final problem, anything else. But I've also tried acupuncture, and I don't know if anybody has tried that. For me, my body reacted very violently to it. However, in other people, they have found it can help to ease some of the symptoms that can be associated with the obstruction. For example, nausea or vomiting, and certain types of pain, because sometimes when you get the pseudo obstruction, it's so intense that you can't even point to your pain. And another thing that many of us have to deal with is, go ahead.
This is Candace. I'd be curious to know what motility drugs other people are on. I'm on, well, the Relistor injections, Reglan 10 milligrams four times a day, Domperidone 10 milligrams four times a day, and 10 to 12 doses of Miralax daily. Mm-hmm. Anybody else on motility drugs?
Yes, it's Sarah here. Pre-chemical isoclavarine hydrochloride.
What do you take, Sarah? I couldn't hear you.
It's called isoclavarine hydrochloride.
And do you find that helpful?
Yep, very.
Wow, that's great. It's so good to hear things that are working for patients. And these are things that patients can perhaps present to their physician to see if that might work for them. Because, again, what works for one may not, but when there's an opportunity to back up help, you know, you might want to consider it.
It's always
that's
worth
great.
Mentioning.
Yeah, exactly. That's great. Do any of you with suit obstruction also have gastroparesis?
Yes, Candace.
Sometimes they go hand in hand. Okay. Do any of you have bladder involvement?
Yes.
Candace, yes.
Wow. Okay. So
I have a neurogenic bladder. I've had to cast myself to pee for 12 years now.
Gosh.
Yeah. A lot of people don't realize, but in certain circumstances, acute obstruction can have that bladder, affect the bladder. So it can really affect or impact so many parts of your body, and they're still learning about this. I know one of my major concerns is when you have food obstruction and you get a flu, it's hard to discern if it's food obstruction or if it's a flu or something else going on. And so it's really hard to evaluate, and that's why when it's flu season, I just, oh, my God, get me through this season, and praying hard that I don't get it, because it's you just don't know. Every layer of illness, you just don't know. So it's very hard. But knowing that at least you are familiar with your symptoms and the best of your ability, you realize that it's time to go to the doctor. It's time for you to call your doctor. I know so many patients, they endure so much before they even make that call. So many patients have so much fear that they're paralyzed in going to the hospital or calling the doctor or even wanting to know the results of the test. And I think when you have a medical test, some of the prep that you need to take in order to have that test, it's really extraordinarily hard when you have food obstruction, because they want you to clean out your system for some of them. And then, you know, I know in my case, it would take a whole fleet to have anything move. And at this point in my life with the GI doctor I have, and when I first had her as a doctor, I always say this to any doctor, new doctor, but when I first had her as a physician, I came right out and asked her, and I said, I know there's no cure right now for what I have. I know there's not much that you can do, but I want to know if you'd be willing to take me as a patient and just monitor me, and if there's anything else that can be done. And this doctor is so phenomenal. She actually came outside of her desk, looked at me, and gave me a hug and said, it absolutely. And so she has been instrumental and getting me through these things. But when she said, you know, you're at the age where you should be having a colonoscopy, and we hesitated, and I just smiled, and she said, I'm not even going to ask you because I know your answer is going to be no. And she said, I don't blame you because of what you have. It's possibly, in my case, land me in the hospital and cleaning out. Even if they tried to clean me out, I would go and I say that I get my money's worth of what I need. I just keep it and keep it and keep it in my body. So it's really, really hard. And I understand so many of the challenges that all of you are going through. I just have to say at this point that, unfortunately, our program is at the end. And I would just like to thank you all who are here today and for those of you who spoke, for you willing to share a piece of your private world with all of us through CIP. And I pray that today that you will be reassured knowing that you're not alone and that all of us with tube obstruction absolutely understand. Although there are so many countless challenges in your life, I know also you'll get through them. And as you do, you'll be forever changed in ways you don't realize. And one of those is that you become a teacher. And it's so sad for me to learn all of the suffering that you go through. But I know because of your journey, you have touched my heart and life, and you've truly made a difference. I always like to close these programs to remind you all that you are extraordinary heroes in our lives. And I'm so extremely grateful for the honor of having you be here today and know that you remain in my heart, in my thoughts, and in my prayers each and every day. Thank you again. I hope you will join us in our next program. We have, just before I do say goodbye to all of you, in June, our next pseudo obstruction group is taking place on Wednesday, June 18th, same time, same place. For May, we have our Let's Talk series, and our Let's Talk series is an open discussion. So you sign up for it, you can listen or you can talk. And this topic for the month of May is going to be It's All in Your Head, Being Believed. Tomorrow we have a patient group, so if you have any other motility problem as well as we obstruct, you're welcome to participate in that. On the 29th, we have a gastroparesis telephone internet group. On the 31st, we have our Lexington, Massachusetts in-person support group. And then our next pseudo obstruction, as I said, group will be in June 18th. But we have a lot of other programs that are up and coming in June. So if you're interested, you can visit our main website at www.agmg. And there's a hyphen gimotility.org. And from there, you'll see the whole calendar of events of upcoming programs. If you need to email me, you can email me at the word digestive, and then there's a dot, then the word motility at gmail.com. And our phone number here is 781-275-1300. And with that, I would like to thank you all again, and God bless you all.
Thank you, Mary Angela.
Thank you, Mary Angela.
My pleasure.
Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.